Welcome to EIR Talks. On May 28, 2002, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche held an international webcast before a live audience in Washington, D.C., speaking from Germany. The webcast was entitled, How to Win the Peace. This week we bring you his responses to a number of questions from the international audience.
You got any advice, Lynn?
Well, I'll just say, there is a comment on this thing, because the problem he refers to is there's a movement which is centered around the British royal family to create a world religion, to dissolve existing religions into a world religion as a part of an empire. Now, recall that the way that the Romans set up their control, they set up this system of Pontifex Maximus in which the emperor was the head of the religion. You had some people who had similar ideas in later times. You had, for example, Louis XIV of France made himself the Sun King. He made himself the head of an organized religion. And the French religion was then to worship the Sun King. You had, in the case of Napoleon Bonaparte, imitated Louis XIV and made himself, again, a Sun King. He was a real, and he was the first fascist, so that you get the idea. So what is in its foot today is the attempt to destroy what might be called traditional religious bodies and to grind them up as in a blender and come out with a kind of soup. And what you have is that most of these things, for example, the typical form of this, which is typical of the United States, you have a pro-fascist group associated with a Hansen case in Northern Virginia, Robert Hansen, the FBI man, with a funny sex life. And this group is closely affiliated around the so-called single-issuism with the right-wing thunder boys like Robertson and Falwell. So what you have is you have the extreme, almost satanic quality of fundamentalists. The complete fakers and frauds and so on. Diamond Pat Robertson. Huh? These guys are in bed politically in the what was called the Christian Coalition. They then discreetly changed that with these so-called Catholics who have exactly the same fundamental politics, but they have it in a different variety. What you've got then is a pantheonic formation of you have different religious cults, but they're all controlled by a mother cult, a world religion. And this is no good. This is the substitute for ecumenicism. You know, I say sometimes I think we have every priest wants to dictate catechism, and not enough of them are missionaries who want to nourish and save souls and help people save themselves. The missionary impulse, which I think is the recommended one, is we should look at every human being as made in the image of the Creator, and we should try to, as a good missionary does, try to say what we have to say to that person on that basis and view every person as precious. And if they believe that man is made in the image of the Creator and has certain responsibilities thereby, we already have a pretty good start. We don't need any pantheon. We don't need some world dictator specifying what are not approved religions. We simply have to have an ecumenical fraternity of the type that Moses Mendelssohn, who was an Orthodox Jew to the day he died, represented in his time, and which actually Philo of Judaeus earlier represented for Jews. We need that ecumenical view of mankind, particularly Jews, Muslims, and Christians, who have to set the example for the believers in this common principle of God and man. And whatever difference we have, fine. But let us deal with each other only on that basis. And this kind of corruption that we're being subjected to now would fade away. But we start to get into single-issue debates and fights over this and agreements on this and so forth. This is when the enemy comes in and you think Mephistopheles has come in and taken over the whole joint, the whole operation, and everybody's a Faust. So I think this is an important issue. I think more people should be aware of it. You saw the protests against the Middle East atrocities. Most of the basic churches, the established churches, religious bodies in the United States protested against it, but only the nuts who were for Sharon were heard by the press. The honest Christians, the honest Muslims, the honest Jews were not heard. Only the nuts were heard. And that's frightening. And that's what I think is the message that should go to Dallas.
Thank you, Lynn. Before we start taking some more questions from the live audience, we have a question that's been submitted by several former members of the Clinton administration who are listening to Mr. LaRouche's broadcast, and I'd like to ask it because I'd like them to be able to hear his answer directly. Their question is, Mr. LaRouche, there's no doubt that the challenge of the moment poses a question of courage, but it also poses a question of what will work and what is effective. And since none of us are inclined to sacrifice ourselves for the more sake of it, the mere sake of it, which is an understatement, it is useful, I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself, it's useful when there is a historic precedent to lean on. You've spoke often of the example of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his actions that brought us out of the Great Depression. What, in your mind, is key from FDR's 33 to 45 recovery strategy for us to look to today?
I don't think there's anything in particular that you should look to. I think everything should be looked at. Because we've done this report, which Richard Freeman has pulled together in large part, on what the lessons are of the recovery programs of Franklin Roosevelt, particularly during the 1930s. And we've also done earlier studies, which we published on the same matter, of what the effect was, the relationship between the economic potential which was developed in the United States under the recovery program, which made possible the mobilization for strategic victory in World War II, in the way it was done. We emerged from World War II as the only world power. And we could have done a lot of good if Roosevelt had lived. So you have to look at the whole man and his knowledge to see what the precedent is. Now we had, you know, like Harold Lickies, each of them did their part. Each of them did a mission for Roosevelt. They were good people. They did an excellent job. But there's something behind it. Look for the driving force, not just for the detail. Don't try to get the package. You get the image of Roosevelt's way of thinking applied to the problems as they presented themselves to him concretely at the time. That's what we have to do now. Now, Roosevelt's thinking, what is it? And people know it, especially of my generation and earlier. They know it. I represent, though a different individual, as Franklin Roosevelt represented, and Abraham Lincoln represented before me, and John Quincy Adams represented before him, I represent an embodiment of the American intellectual tradition, which I referred to in the beginning of my remarks today. That I had a contemporary, Reverend Daniel Wood, a Quaker minister, who started his career in Carolinas fighting slavery, and he had to get out of there. He went up to Ohio, and just north of Columbus, Ohio, he set up shop, married into one of the families up there, and he set up his own operation there, and he ran the Underground Railroad in Delaware County, north of Columbus, during that relevant period, that of the escaped slaves running into Canada. And he had the top of his church and barn and school, which he set up, were all used to house the slaves as they were being moved north toward Canada. Now, he was a contemporary of Lincoln. He was also a contemporary of Henry Clay, with whom he had an encounter on one occasion. And you had this American Whig tradition, which emerged around President Monroe, John Quincy Adams, the Careys, Matthew and his son, Henry C. Carey, to some degree Friedrich List, though he was somewhat a different case, even though he was important as an economist, and they had a protege. And their key protege was Abraham Lincoln, who was the spokesman used by John Quincy Adams in delivering the spot speech, the spot resolution, in the Congress against Polk's fraud in starting the Mexican-American War. And it was that Lincoln, who was a highly educated man, he was no dummy, one of the most brilliant men in all American history, part of the process. So we have, those of us who remember, who studied, who lived, who know what the American Revolution was, who know the tradition, act in a certain way, as opposed to those who have what's called the American Tory tradition, which is hegemonic in the United States today. And what you have to understand is that Roosevelt, read Roosevelt's graduation paper, or his final paper at Harvard, on this tradition. Look at his studies while he was fighting poliomyelitis. Studies of his legacy. Look at his ancestor, Isaac Roosevelt, the collaborator of Alexander Hamilton. And the point was that Franklin Roosevelt had two things. He represented a family tradition, an embodiment of the American intellectual tradition, the tradition on which this nation was founded, the tradition of Benjamin Franklin. He also represented a man of extreme courage. And those are the two qualities that are needed. You need a person like a great general. MacArthur had that same quality in a different, completely different dimension. The quality of a leader, a true leader, who knows something needs to be done. And if he knows it needs to be done, he will seize the opportunity to do it with resolution. He will seek out collaborators who want to take a chunk of the job. And he will give them backing to do the job, as he did Harry Hopkins, for example. And that's the way you do it. You get the essence of the American tradition, the American economic tradition. You have to have, above all, for example, to understand the distinction between the roots of the American Constitution and Declaration of Independence, which are found in Leibniz, in such writings as the New Essays on Human Understanding. This was the doctrine which was posed by Leibniz in opposition to that fascist scum, John Locke, who is the patron saint of slavery in the United States. The Confederate Constitution contains in the preamble the affirmation of life, liberty, and property, the doctrine of John Locke, the constitution of slavery, the constitution of degradation, the constitution of treason against the United States. Whereas the Declaration of Independence and the preamble of the Federal Constitution uphold two principles. The sovereignty of the United States must be defended, and that sovereign power used under all circumstances. Secondly, the general welfare of present and future generations, posterity, must be promoted. That is the fundamental constitutional law of the United States, which is not exactly being observed these days. And those two principles, which express this legacy, the whole legacy of the struggle against conditions in which some people are treated as human cattle, to create a society in which we have a society fit for men, women, a society in which all people are equally human, which they participate equally in society, which we do not make a differentiation between the rulers who behave like beasts toward the ruled who are treated like human cattle. And the American intellectual tradition reflects the use of European philosophy, European accomplishments, to bring forth that kind of idea in this nation. And those of us who understand that and who understand how important it is and who are prepared to fight and die for it, and to make ourselves competent in doing that, we can do the job. And we have to see that side of Franklin Roosevelt and look at his courage, look at his tradition, and really understand him from the inside, not from his externalities. And then all his externalities and some of the questionable aspects of them all fall neatly into place. This man was a great man. He was a man who tried to walk in the footsteps of Abraham Lincoln in restoring this nation to itself after the presidency of the pro-Confederacy, Teddy Roosevelt, the Ku Klux Klan fanatic, Woodrow Wilson, and that all-around scoundrel, Calvin Coolidge, together with Mellon, Andrew Mellon, had ruined the United States in the course of the earlier part of the 20th century. That's the picture you have to grasp. You cannot make a Laura Croft president. You can't pit together a morph of parts and make it human. You have to touch the innermost humanity of the individual. Evoke it in the individual. And you will get out of that a leader. But that's why I did what I said at the beginning. In times like this, you have to ask, who am I and what am I? Where do I belong in the scheme of eternity? What is the meaning of my having had parents and grandparents and so forth? What is the meaning of this nation? What are its accomplishments? What do I represent for this nation? Not for what I get for my satisfaction now, but what am I supposed to do? What did God put me here to do? And do it. Then you find in yourself the courage to do what's necessary. Obviously, Franklin Roosevelt found that. But there is, while I can recommend and detail many things that Roosevelt did, which I would defend as models, but that is not the force, the mainspring that makes the clock tick. The mainspring lies in the character of the individual and the development of that character. Franklin Roosevelt admired his great ancestor, Isaac Roosevelt, and he worked to defend the United States for the American intellectual tradition, the actual tradition behind our Declaration of Independence, our struggle for freedom, and the preamble of our Constitution. If once you've got that, and then you know the technicalities, you know what to do. Just a matter of training. We've got plenty of people among former Clinton people who have the skills or can get them from others, people they know. We can do the job. If you work for me, you'd get the job done.
I'd like to take a couple of questions from the live audience now. The first person I'm going to call to the microphone is Mr. Muyadeen Alisi from Baltimore.
Greetings, Mr. LaRouche. Well, I've just been inundated with your perspective on new violence, especially the component about video games, and I fundamentally disagree, sir. Well, I agree that it does desensitize the youth from violent acts, but unless it destroys your level of rationale, I don't think it's something to really go after. So I'd like to have your answer to that. Yeah.
Okay. I've done a very careful study of this question of this new violence, and you have to take what I say very seriously because I'm an expert. And in this sense, first of all, what you're dealing with here is you're dealing with a game. Now, by definition, a game is not reality. A game is made up of artificial rules. Now, what happens with this is these young people, and it has to do also with their generation. Remember, the key to the new violence is not simply the games themselves. The key to the new violence is the so-called punk generation phenomenon, otherwise called the no future generation. What has happened in the United States to make this possible is that the older generation, the parents of those who are now, say, between, or younger people under 25, who have been drifted into the punk generation, represent the betrayal of them by their parents. That's the beginning of the problem. Most people in that bracket sense themselves betrayed. Maybe not in the sense of active, you betrayed me, but a sense of estrangement from their parents, that the parents are the enemy. If you look at the punk rock product, which I look to as little as possible, but the impression is very clear. This is a doctrine of hatred. It's especially a doctrine of hatred against society and against their parents' generation. Now, some of that hatred has, in a sense, been earned, because the parents' generation have put up with a society, a philosophy, which in a sense has produced children under 25 years of age who essentially have no future in the United States as it has gone and as it is going today. That's your first basis, first principle. See, when people are happy, when people are educated, and you're not educated in American schools today, the American public school system, the secondary school system, and also increasingly universities are a complete farce. That is, the intellectual experience does not occur on the university campuses. You have high school students graduating with honors from high school, weeping, I don't know anything. I never came to know anything at this school. You look at some of the samples of the test programs. You read it. You're disgusted. I'm disgusted. Is that called education? What we're doing to children in our school systems in the Washington, D.C. area, for example, the Beltway area, is disgusting. Is criminal. What do we give them? We accept the society of the latchkey children phenomenon. We accept all these conditions. People accept a society where you commute tremendous. If you work, you commute. Maybe among three jobs in a week, not just one. There is no family life. There is no community life. There's no intellectual or spiritual activity within the family. The children are thrown on the streets like it used to be, say, in the Harlem ghetto, among the poorest in the Harlem ghetto, New York. They're on the streets. They're street children. This is a variety of street children. Now, what do you do? Daddy says, oh, kid, don't bother me. I'll get you a game. You have a child who's rejected, intellectually, emotionally rejected. He's given a game. The game becomes fashionable. The game is designed to be addictive. The games were designed to create killers. That is, the people who designed the core of these games intended to create killers. Terminator 2. You get a little kit. You take it and you plug it in the wall. And you become Terminator 2. Look, the kid who takes a point-and-shoot exercise. A little kid. Point-and-shoot exercise. Will become more skilled than a man who's been on a firing range for 10 years. Because he can fire more times with more precision and lower cost than the military could ever do for him. He can go from that game, having never touched a weapon in his life, and on the basis of that training by that game, particularly if he plays it in a multi-person circle where they're tied in like a LAN network, he will become more skilled as a killer and more psychotic as a killer than there were Special Forces case. What we are training in the United States today is we're training the new Special Forces. Jobless, hopeless youth, under 18 and higher, who have developed point-and-shoot skills and reactions which qualify them immediately to become stone killers for an expanded U.S. military force of the type prescribed by Samuel P. Huntington. They exist. Now, we have to look at the case of the state of the mind of the punk generation youngster, the no future generation youngster, who lives in conditions approximately like what I've described. The conditions of the new economy, Joe Lieberman's great new economy, with no social life, no redeeming social life, no cognitive development, who spends his time numbing his mind and being occupied playing these games, particularly in group formats. You create what's called a subculture of game players, and they generally associate with certain types of games. Now, what happens then is, under those conditions, with that load of hate sitting in the belly of the youngster, you give him violence games. What does he do? It's not the game itself that's dangerous. It's the way it's done. What he becomes is he becomes involved in that. He becomes schizophrenic. That is, he lives outside the real world and lives in a world of games, video game world, a world of fantasy and magic. Therefore, what he becomes is a member of a killer-oriented, violence-oriented, sadism-oriented expression of the built-up load of hate sitting in his gut. And this becomes a socially induced form of mass schizophrenia. Now, let's take the case of the guy in Erfurt, Germany, the shooter, who is one of these guys who fits exactly the typical model of the American teenage game player, video game player. He's typical of it. And I've had these guys write me, and what they write proves that I'm right, because the way they write, the way they argue, corresponds exactly to this schizophrenia. That is, How does schizophrenia work? The game player is in a mindset, the mindset of the game, the rules of the game. So therefore, he thinks like the rules of the game. Remember, it's a competitive game. You're either competing against yourself, against the machine, or other competitors. So everything except the rules of the game are irrelevant to you while you're locked up in hours on end with this playing this game out. Now, if someone comes in and raises a question of reality, your dinner's ready, or eating dinner's important, you react against them because they're bringing into your game world, they're bringing an element of reality which for you does not exist in the game world. That's why you're schizophrenic. You have divorced yourself from reacting to society reality. You're now reacting primarily to a set of rules, childish rules, which you play by. So what you have, the result, therefore, is since what you're, the game you're playing is magic, it has no correspondence to the real world, you are now in a socially induced state of psychosis, a schizophrenic psychosis. It is not like normal psychosis. Why? Take the case of what happened in Erfurt. This kid went through the school killing teachers, and a couple of students had gotten his way. One teacher said, called him by name and said, look me in the eye. The kid stopped, went into the other room, the teacher locked him in, and the kid shot himself. What had happened? The kid was two people. One person was the guy who went in the room and shot himself. The other was the kid who was playing the game. He played the game as a mass murderer. But the minute he was struck by reality in an impressive way, when the teacher said, look in my eyes, that was a change. He suddenly flipped back into his real human personality, which is a pathetic, frightened, weak personality. And shot himself to get out of the game. That's what these games are doing. But the point is, as I said, you cannot explain the games by the game itself. Yes, the people who develop these games, who market the games, they know exactly what they're doing. The intention behind the production and marketing of these games is to create mass killers in the United States through video games. One who accepts the games is going to play that role because that's what they're programmed to do. And that's the intention behind the people who make the money out of selling these games. But the problem is that the reason why the person becomes a victim is because we, with our consumer society, with our post-1966 society, the unreal society, which what is real is what you get, not what you produce.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with a continuation of Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002.
Before 1966, what was real was the opportunity to produce something yourself. The right to produce, the right to have a job, the right to be productive, the right to be respected because you're useful. After 1966, the shift came is not what you are or what you produce or what you can do that's important. It's what you can get. Like on a credit card. And we got a big credit card for the United States. It's called the current account deficit. Okay? Big credit card. You can buy anything from any part of the world, but you don't have to pay for it. And that's the day you have to, and then it becomes painful. Okay? So that is the problem. So you have to look at the point is we have destroyed our children. Our children are bodies of rage, and somebody comes along like a prostitute, a pimp, comes along to the children and pimps to them and says, You want to get your kicks? I can give you a pleasure. Play the game. It's an ugly, evil story. But what you have to do to understand this thing, if you've been a video game player, you have to see exactly what I just told you. You have to see why, what the load of hate is in your belly, your sense of estrangement, of alienation from society, in your belly, which causes you to flee from reality into the magic of an electronic game. And there you release this load of hatred, of frustration, which comes from what was called enomi, in your belly, and it controls you. Therefore, you become two people. On the one hand, you're potentially a human being. That's your real self. But on the other hand, you have a socially induced form of mass psychotic schizophrenia, which is induced in you by conditioning through the game. This is Pavlovian brainwashing, pure and simple, which produces a person who's a real person on the one side but has an artificial personality, a game-like personality, on the other side. And they flip back and forth between the two states.
We have a question submitted by Mr. Ismail El Amin from NTV in Beirut, Lebanon. He says, Mr. LaRouche, can you please connect the dots that the FBI and CIA had during the summer 2001 about a possible attack against the United States by Al-Qaeda militants, and why Mr. Bush had his daily intelligence briefing on August the 6th delivered by a low-level CIA officer instead of his usual briefer, George Tenet?
Well, the problem here is that the real fraud in the story is the way this thing was spun to say that the president had access, in this sense, to information that Al-Qaeda was going to do an attack in that period. That is a lie. That is not the information that the U.S. intelligence services had. I happen to have been involved in investigating some of these problems in the Washington, D.C. area and put out a report on this subject. What we had was around the issue of the anti-globalization demonstrations organized under Teddy Goldsmith, who was the brother of Jimmy Goldsmith, now deceased and so forth, which had been organized partly out of places like Porto Alegre in Brazil, the thing that ran the Genoa riots, the thing that ran the riots in Seattle, so forth, that this thing was coming on much stronger and was targeting Washington, D.C. And what the FBI was doing and others responsible was a bunch of incompetence in terms of the security of Washington, D.C. for late September of 2001. Now, I was involved in a sort of consulting oversight and discussion capacity with a lot of people on this problem, and I was concerned about it. But we had, coming up for the period of September, we had a multi-phased security threat to the security of the United States. Now, what has not been said, and probably will not be said, as a matter of fact, the Vice President Cheney made some remarks which tend to concur with what I know on this subject. What we had is we had a general security threat. But with the operation we're looking at here, in terms of the September 11th, is not something that Al-Qaeda is capable of doing. I don't care how many times people said Al-Qaeda did it and came from Osama bin Laden. It did not happen. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda did not have the capability of even beginning to do what happened to the United States on September 11th. So you say you had information they were going to do it, just because you now wish to say they did it, it doesn't mean it's true. There is no truth to the official story about Osama bin Laden being the author of what happened in New York and in Washington, D.C. on September 11th. Nor has any government official of any government ever presented the slightest whiff of credible evidence, of plausible evidence, to show that. No proof has ever been submitted. So the government is around bombing the world, and no proof has been submitted that the alleged perpetrator actually did it. That's your FBI at work for you. We're going to convict him anyway. Why bother with proof? That kind of mentality. So the president did not have any such information. No one gave him such information. He didn't miss the boat on anything. What you have is a couple of Democratic fakers who've gotten in the act of the Joe Lieberman type, who are trying to spin this into a story that the president, the incompetence of the president, didn't know what was going on. Nobody knew what's going on except the perpetrators. This was a highly sophisticated military-type operation which had been in preparation for a year to 2 years highly planned, could not have been done by any of the so-called alleged perpetrators. You have to ask yourself a question. Why did all the planes were scheduled to go in the air at the same time, about the same time, from Dallas and from Boston? Why didn't they hit Washington first? They look at the movement. Some of this is on the internet. Reports of this stuff in the declassified section of the exact routes of these planes and what time they were supposed to take off. How they maneuvered. How the maneuvers were coordinated. These planes each made a turn after the previously assigned turn had made its hit. Why'd they hit New York Towers? Because whoever did it intended to blame Arabs tied to Al-Qaeda for it. See, what would have happened if they'd hit Washington first? They probably would have gotten the president and probably the Secretary of Defense. What did they do by hitting New York first? Well, in Member New York, there was a big agricultural fertilizer bomb was put in the basement of one of the Twin Towers in New York. There was a trial up there. Some people went to jail. This guy who was tied to Al-Qaeda, this sheikh, who had been a U.S. asset tied to Al-Qaeda, was indicted and convicted of the process. So by hitting the Twin Towers first, you pin the tail on the donkey of Al-Qaeda, at least in the minds of all paranoid Americans, of which there are an abundant supply, including probably the president, who is not exactly the sharpest intelligence agent in the world. So there was no basis for it. So why does somebody come out and say they have evidence? The evidence is a secret operation which nobody expected hit. But we had a great number of things on which there were many reports floating around, and I was involved in some of this stuff. Reports of security threats to New York and other ways associated with a terrorist component of the same people who ran Seattle, Genoa, and so forth. They were about to hit Washington in a way which I said was a national security threat. So I said, we have to look at this thing when this kind of planning, we looked at the way this thing was being covered up, the way this was being put in place. This was big. No responsible government would allow that to happen. An open plan to a virtual insurrectionary state of affairs in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital? What government in the world would let that happen, would not intervene to head it off before it happened? Well, they weren't doing it. And that was the big scandal. Sure, the president was briefed. Almost everyone, probably everybody in the Washington, D.C. police department was briefed on that one. Every police department, the sheriff's department, and the surrounding area of Washington, D.C. was briefed on that one. Of course, there were reports all over the place. But has it anything to do with the story that's being told about the claims made by the Democrats? Was there any proof that Al-Qaeda was involved? Never. No proof has ever been submitted, and none could be submitted, not conclusive, because Al-Qaeda couldn't have done it. It's not within their capability.
The next question has been submitted by Ilyas Hassan Chowdhury from the Weekly Mirror International and Radio Haya Ala Falah in Houston, Texas. He says, Mr. LaRouche, India is on the verge of attacking Pakistan, the leading ally of the United States in the ongoing war on terrorism. What do you have to say about this issue?
Well, first of all, there is a high risk of a Indian military move in Kashmir. What is happening at the same time is there's something being said which is highly improbable, that this state of tension could lead to a nuclear war attack by Pakistan or a nuclear war in the subcontinent. That I do not believe impossible. Why are people saying that? Because people in the U.S. government and other governments know exactly what was done to prevent the Pakistan use of nuclear weapons. The Indians know about it, are fully informed about it. The agreement is among the nations of the area that Pakistan weapons are sealed, so a nuclear attack from Pakistan cannot occur at this time. And Pakistan is operating under guarantees, implicit guarantees and actual guarantees from the United States and other countries, which say there's nothing for you to worry about. Now, there is a problem in Kashmir. And the problem is this. And some people in the United States are making stupid errors on this thing. One thing you do not insist upon in the Kashmir question, as an American, any outsider, you do not tell them they must negotiate a settlement on the Kashmir question between India and Pakistan. No such pressure from outsiders must be made. Leave the situation alone. The Kashmir issue is a long issue. The division goes back to back to 1946-47. It's been heated up since then. The only two parties who should initiate any discussion on Kashmir and Kashmir as such are India and Pakistan as such on their own initiative. No outsider should stick his nose into it. Now, if both parties want guarantees for what they both want, then you should help them. But if they don't invite you in, don't stick your snout in the situation. But the problem is that there are elements which the Pakistan government does not efficiently control. The United States government and British are more responsible. The introduction of this kind of terrorism, which is talked about in Afghanistan and so forth, was introduced to the area by the United States and Britain back under Brzezinski. Brzezinski was the guy who started the terrorism in Afghanistan and operated, in a sense, with two Pakistan to set up this thing as a trap for the Soviet Union, which worked. Now, what they've done, they've gone in and bombed Afghanistan. The worst stupid thing they could do. But they did it. They said they had to do it for the war against terrorism because of what happened in New York and Washington. It had nothing to do with what happened in New York and Washington. New York and Washington was used as a pretext for this bombing of Afghanistan. There's a geopolitical operation which is called the Clash of Civilizations, which is a controlling operation for this, as described by Huntington and others, the New Roman Empire operation, which is going in place, which might lead to a general war. But neither Pakistan nor India want a nuclear exchange. They want a stable situation. However, the Kashmir situation is inherently unstable. And we just hope now that we get through June without any war fighting. There are no simple solutions. There's no simple right or wrong in this thing. This is an old, ugly wound. Our concern should be to keep stability and peace in that area. Then one of the big problems there is that Pakistan's economy is in terrible shape. The condition of the people of Pakistan is desperate in God's part. The economy depends to a large degree upon Afghan drug trafficking, which is still going on full force, bigger than ever, from the area. The United States bombing of Afghanistan did not decrease the drug trafficking, it increased it. You're going to have any government you try to set up in Afghanistan is going to be about less stable than any previous government since the last Afghan war started. The United States will never win the war in Afghanistan. Never. It will get worse and worse and worse, and the effects of continuing the war will spread into the adjoining regions. The best thing the United States could do is get out of there. Make that kind of decision. Get out of there. We made the mess. The best thing to do is to concern ourselves with helping Pakistan to build its economy up again so it doesn't depend upon drug trafficking. And so the drug traffickers in Pakistan do not have control in Pakistan politics, and to find ways with aid of other countries, such as China, and this discussion with India, to bring about some kind of equanimity in the situation. Don't try to find solutions. Don't try to find the big thing. This thing is going to happen. This thing is going to happen. What you want to do is keep it quiet as possible. Prevents instability. The long-term solution is Pakistan's economy must be rebuilt. And Pakistan is going to be an inherently unstable country until that is done. The issue with India and operations which run from outside of India into India are also dangerous. There are forces in India which are dangerous. And you have to think about what you're doing when you meddle in Indian affairs. Do you want the extreme right wing turn loose in India? The people that killed Gandhi of that type? You want them turned loose? You can have hell on the subcontinent. Do you want the operation that the British and others are running in Nepal? Do you want that operation? So why not? We should not let the American press propaganda and similar kinds of propaganda fool us into saying we must run in with instant solutions, an instant settlement one way or the other. What we want is people to stop killing each other. We want the people involved in the situation to have some degree of amity and let them work out the problems. And our job is to decide where we should, if invited, intervene with the agreement of both parties. But we should not be sticking our snout in there. This is like the ugly Yankee, the ugly American image in Laos years ago. We are bad. Get the picture clearly. The United States around the world today is a bad guy. The U.S. military around the United States and U.S. policy is a bad guy. Not liked. Hated and resented and feared in the Balkans. Increasingly hated in Europe, in Western Europe, in France, in Germany, and elsewhere. If they had their courage in Germany, they'd speak up, but they don't. They've been through two wars in the United States. They don't want to have a third one. The hatred of what's happened in Poland and Eastern Europe, the same. What the United States has done to Central and South America is hated. We're not the good guys. What the United States has done in Africa, we're not the good guys. Yes, the British have done things too, the same evil type. We're bad guys. So instead of, I may be a good guy, but my government is not a good guy right now. You want to get me to intervene? Well, unfortunately, I don't have any means. But I'll do anything to help these guys to try to get, if they want me, to help them get some peace, to have some amity. But our government is not of that disposition. Our government is trying to find rogues. It's trying to find bad guys to bomb. But they're the bad guys. And therefore, yes, there is reason for concern about this danger of a clash in Kashmir. It could go out of control. It could be a control operation, whether somebody makes an operation, a large-scale Indian operation, which is not intended to start a general war. It's simply a punch to say, get your terrorists, your bases, out of northern Kashmir, because we can't stand them right now. Get those terrorists out of northern Kashmir. And that's the issue. If that thing was settled, then India and Pakistan could settle it themselves. So we don't need to worry about this in that way. We do have to worry about what might happen. But now the issue, as you describe it, is not what the problem is. It's something similar to what you described. It looks similar. But the issue is being played up by the U.S. press and the international press. Is a misrepresentation of the situation on the ground, as I know it from firsthand sources.
I'd like to take another question now from the audience, which is gathered here, before I go back to some of the questions that are being submitted via the internet. Mauro, did you want to ask a question? Why don't you come on up?
Greetings for you, Mr. LaRouche. The next question comes out in terms of philosophy. You know, it's known that the universe and I exist together, right? So all the things and I are one. So from that standpoint, I can say that we cannot create or destroy things, just change them, right? So we can make a discovery with our human cognition, or we can change things that already exist. So this comes in terms of all the new, Bush administration policy of axis of evil. So he's trying to destroy the evil, and he's creating more evil. So do you actually believe that we can destroy evil, or we can change it in order to create good? Because as I stated before, we are just one thing. We cannot destroy it or create things. Just discover it then or change it. All right, thanks.
Oh no, it's not quite so bad as that. But there's a principle involved in this, which your question has a certain relevance. Right, go at it sideways. You have two types of classical drama. One is called tragedy. A tragedy, the classical tragedies are based either on mythologies, like the classical Greek tragedies, which refer to the Homeric Odysseys, which are partly historical, but partly they're other things. They also contain a lot of truth, as was shown by Schliemann. Or they're based on real history. Now, the classical tragedies, the classical histories, the English histories of Shakespeare are based on actual history. For example, Shakespeare based himself on a report published by Sir Thomas More on the history of the kings of England from Henry II to Richard III, pertaining to the ascension to power of Henry VII. Now, these are actual histories, and they pertain to portraits of the actual issues which defined that period. And then also, as well as Shakespeare's tragedies, as well as Schiller's tragedies, all describe actual historical situations, or mythical ones. In Schiller's case, they're historical situations. And every Schiller play is based on history and is an accurate account of the essence of the history. All right, so you have the two kinds of classical. One is the so-called tragedy, and the other is called the sublime. Now, the difference is this. Every tragedy, true tragedy, is caused by the people themselves, not by a leader of a society. The fault of the leader is that the people have selected that kind of leader. And the selection comes from popular opinion. And popular opinion is the root of all evil in terms of tragedy. That is, the people cannot change themselves, and the leader who should lead them to change themselves fails to do so. That's typical tragedy. Plato came up with a conception of tragedy, which is different, which is called the Plato Dialogues, which is called the sublime. Now, in every Plato dialogue, you have a problem, a contradiction between failure and success. Well, beliefs doesn't work. So, but in each case, the Socratic dialogue develops a solution, the experience of discovering a solution by which the people in the drama, in this case the dialogue, are able to change the situation, to lift the people above themselves, and thus to escape from the tragedy. The most famous case of the sublime in a modern classic is the case of the Schiller's portrayal of the case of Jeanne d'Arc in France. Now, except for one change in detail, which was done by Schiller for dramatic purposes to make the thing work on stage, the account of Jeanne d'Arc's case by Schiller as a drama corresponds historically to the actual case of Jeanne d'Arc or actual history. So in this case, you have a France which is doomed to go through a cycle of the same of Plantagenet, etc., crisis they've been through before. But it doesn't. Because of the intervention of one person who's determined to force a solution, the establishment of France as a nation, not as something controlled by contending factions, feudal factions. And it works. This is real history. It really happened that way. So in a case like this, when you've got a tragedy, you've got two sides who are about to kill each other. One says the other is evil, the other says the other is evil. You don't approach this by saying, well, which is the most evil? We're going to kill the most evil one and solve the problem. You will not solve the problem. Because the conflict, which seems like a fight between evil and evil, is a result of a common failure of both. Therefore, you must introduce not a choice between the two proposed options, but you must find a third choice which actually works, which actually eliminates the evil by introducing the good. In other words, attacking the evil, trying to destroy that which bears evil, is not producing good. You have to introduce the good per se. For example, you go into a country which is destroyed, as we went into Germany in part, and some of the things we did there in the post-war period were horrible, some were right. You go into a country, you defeated the people who rule the country. What do you do for the people? You try to do good for them. You help them rebuild their economy. You cooperate with them. You try to establish a stable, healthy society where the one you just defeated existed. You express love toward the humanity of the people by good deeds, by doing good. And thus you will get the people themselves to accept you because you come after they've hated you. and you come to people who have hated you, and you do good for them, they stop hating you. They may resent you, but they stop hating you when they cooperate. The point is, our military policy in the United States stinks. Our foreign policy stinks. Because the way we should deal with the people of South and Central America, with Africa, with Eurasia, we should deal with these countries with love, not with hate. We should find ways in which we can demonstrate to them that we are committed to a good for them as well as for ourselves. If we do that, from what I know of the world, most of the problems of the world today among nations could be solved. You have a few hard cases that will not give up. They want to go on killing. But in most of the world, most of the people want peace. They want security. They're human beings. They have human aspirations. Yes, we should have a powerful army. We should have a powerful military, but not for purposes of killing, but for purposes of being able to defend ourselves when we have to. But the purpose of the military is not to kill, but to protect. It's a principle of strategic defense. Our aggressive policy must be a policy of doing good, going into a country and helping them when they are willing to accept our help. If a country is down, we offer our help. And that's the way we should conduct our foreign policy.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.